Hello, welcome to our podcast from IIM Innovation in Motion, where we discuss various topics related to venture capital and investing in early stage companies. My name is Lydia Kincaid. I'm the managing director, and we have Lee Harris, our managing member of our organization as well. So you've heard us talk before about different components of portfolio structure and due diligence, but today we're going to dig a little bit deeper and specifically what both of those topics mean, especially given this current economic climate. I think you can probably see every day the headlines of what's going on in the early stage investment space, where investors are holding back in some cases, and founders are having a harder time raising capital, not just in the amounts of capital that they need, but the length of time that it's taking founders to raise that money. Lee, before we launch into really thinking through portfolio construction, especially in this kind of environment, do you want to lay the land, tell us a lay of the land a little bit more about the status of the investment environment right now?
Yeah, the investment environment is no surprise to anyone, is difficult. Later stage companies and later funding rounds have dried up significantly. Early stage companies have still been able to raise some capital, but it is becoming even more difficult with all the interest rate increases from the Fed, with the chances still of a recession in this country. There's a lot of investment capital out there sitting on the sidelines, but it's been a little more difficult to pry it away from the investors and deploy it. And I think you mentioned this, investors need to give a great deal of thought to the way they construct a portfolio of early stage companies. This is a perfect time to invest because valuations that had gotten crazy at seed stage and the early stage funding rounds, we saw for a while $12 to $15 million valuations from companies with no revenue. Those have now recalibrated back in the four, five, six, even $7 million range, which is much more realistic. constructing a portfolio is something that early stage investors need to pay more attention to. There's a lot of angel groups that play the field, and they invest in whatever company seems attractive, regardless of the vertical. At IIM, we have been very, very disciplined about the verticals and subverticals in which we invest. We are investing in agriculture, in animal health, and in human health, and we don't invest in pharma and the type of human health companies that have long, long runways to success and exit. If it's going to take 10 years for a human health company, that's just too long. So there are sub verticals that we have targeted, and I think that's something that's extremely important. If there's an investor group that's been around for a while, it may be well for them to take a step back and look at the way they've constructed the portfolio. How well is it working? How many zombie companies do they have in that portfolio? A zombie company is the walking dead, the company that's not gonna survive, but it's still hanging on with the hope that perhaps there'll be somebody that'll come along and buy the IP or whatever. I think it's really dangerous to play the field in this environment where there's little in-depth knowledge in these sectors that angel groups typically invest in. And so targeting a specific number of verticals, ours are three, maybe the sub-verticals, maybe there's a handful of sub-verticals under each of those vertical investment theses, that makes sense. And to do that, there needs to be a real understanding of the risk and return profiles of these verticals. And an asset allocation model really should be constructed. So if you have three verticals, do you invest a third, a third, a third to balance a portfolio? Or is there greater return and higher risk where perhaps it instead of a third, it's only 15 to 18% in that highly risky vertical. And one of the safer verticals maybe has an overweight, but you may have some really outsized returns in that 15 to 18% asset allocation. This is really, really important for investors to become intentional about the way they're constructing this portfolio. And even to the extent of layering investments in companies that potentially have different durations relative to exits. You know, some may be shorter, some may be longer. We usually look at generally 7 to 10 years for a company to go from the point we invest to the point of exit. However, we've had an earlier exit in one particular case, much earlier than that. And we expect to have a few more much earlier exits. But if all of the companies that are acquired are going to be on the same 7 to 10 year pathway, investors can get to the point where they're a little restless, if that's the right word. Why don't we have an exit? I mean, we've had a couple of people in our group have said, shouldn't we have more exits? Well, no, we're early stage, and you know, investing in something 2 or 3 years ago isn't necessarily going to result in an exit that quickly. So there are companies, however, that clearly will exit sooner, and in constructing the portfolio, having that kind of layering effect is probably a good idea. Lydia, the most important thing right now, though, is due diligence. And there are many, many early stage platforms that do relatively little due diligence, or they rely on the due diligence performed by others. And you might speak to this and why it is so much more important today that due diligence be front and center than it has been in the past.
Well, I do think it's even more important today. I mean, it's always been important for us, of course, but I think more and more investors are placing more emphasis on more thorough due diligence. So founders should really expect that going in, even raising, I would say, even some pre-seed rounds, if they're calling them that, even some pre-seed rounds where they're bringing in outside capital. Companies need to expect to go through a thorough due diligence process. So one component of due diligence is financial due diligence. So really paying attention to a company's burn. So how much money are they spending per month? In addition to how much cash do they have in the bank and how much runway does that give them? We actually just had a company pitch to us within the last 60 days that was raising, I think, $2 million in capital, 11 people on their team. And their burn was relatively high. I think 80,000 or so, which for a seed stage company, that's quite high. I mean, we just got an email yesterday from that company saying, we only have $30,000 left in the bank. We really appreciate everyone's time and talking with us about this raise, but we're exploring other options now. We've already been laying off our team members, and we're trying to figure out how to make this work to still keep the company intact. So I think paying special attention to how much longer that company can make it, like even today. And then how much money is this round going to get them, and how can they really get from point A to point B? Whatever they think they need, probably increase that by a third or half, because we know things are going to go wrong. Things are going to cost more money than everybody thinks. They may have to pivot. They may have to do something different. It is going to be exceptionally hard to fundraise, we believe, in the next year, maybe 2 years. So making sure that company is really financially sound is one component of due diligence that we pay really close attention to. Lee, I know that's something you always ask in our meetings with founders. Is there anything else related to burn that you want to mention, even your experience sitting on boards of some of these companies?
Well, and that is something that founders have control over, is the burn. And one of the things that is a little disturbing is how many founders are unwilling. You know, there's so much rose-colored optimism, and that's good that founders and founding teams are optimistic. But there's some cold realities that have to be faced here. And you mentioned this company that is down to $30,000 in the bank with an $80,000 a month burn rate. Had they reduced that burn months ago, It would be much better to cut too much than cut too little and then end up going out of business and wasting the rest of the money. We had I was on a board of a software company way back in 1999 2000 timeframe. That's right when the bubble burst for technology companies and software companies, internet based. And we had raised $11 million, which was a lot of money way back in that day. And I'd attend the board meetings and we had a great plan and we were getting some headway. However, when the bubble appeared to be bursting, the board, including the founders, were very smart and said, there is not a pathway here. We are not going to be able to keep this company alive and come out the other side. And things are changing so much that what we would be better off doing is taking the $4 million we have left over, shutting the company down and distributing the money back to the investors. I thought that was an amazing turn of events, frankly. I mean, we got some cash and the company did the right thing. So many founders will burn through every last dollar before they finally go out of business. And if they had just started months earlier, they may have been able to extend the runway through the difficult periods and survive. So yeah, the whole thing with burn right now has got to be at the top of the list. And if a company, one of the questions we always ask when we're interviewing founders is how much cash you have in the bank. And we also ask, what's your burn rate? And some of them don't really know what their burn rate is, or they gloss it over. And we point out that, in fact, I have pointed out several times in these pipeline calls and in investor presentations that are being made by these companies that you're going to be out of business in 6 months. And, oh, no, we're going to get some grants and we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And it's just, it's not healthy for founders to take that kind of approach. I would much rather have them come in and say, we have right now 6 months of runway left. However, here are the steps that we're taking to decrease the burn. And that 6 months becomes 12 months. And we're looking to raise another 24 to 36 months of runway. And then we're much more interested in investing in that kind of a company rather than one where, as they say, the founder's whistling through the graveyard, hoping that he doesn't trip and fall in a grave, I guess.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And another way that founders can really extend that runway is by applying for and receiving grants. We love to see that as investors, non-dilutive grants coming into the company. There's a lot of local, state level, even federal level funding opportunities for companies. And some of those can be ongoing, recurring year over year. And sometimes like an SBIR grant, maybe like phase one, phase two, that expands over time as well as long as the company is meeting its milestones and objectives and being able to grow. That's some great opportunities for companies to bring more cash to the company. And something else, Lee, that you kind of alluded to that founders may be like not really knowing or not having a good understanding of their like financial status of the company. Something else that's really important in due diligence is good governance. What does the company have in place in terms of a real board of directors? We've said this 100 times, but really a real board of directors that has oversight on the business, budget approvals, you know, some of the basic stuff that we see just absent from some of the really early stage companies is a red flag to us. We want to see that if there is not a board of directors in place, that there will be in very short order and it's part of the fundraising round. And if there's not a full board of directors yet, we usually request that it be us, somebody on our staff or one of our investors who can really help grow that company and provide good guidance. I would say, hands down, the companies in our portfolio, Lee, that have a strong board of directors with experience in that sector or good like financial acumen, strength in their like business experiences, those companies are at a whole different level than companies who didn't put together a thoughtful board of directors in the beginning. I mean, the companies that have made headlines in a bad way in the last year or so had poor governance structures in place. You know, whatever was going on at Theranos, I think Elizabeth Holmes is about to start her jail sentence for that. I mean, there's just all sorts of things that we look for to avoid major, major problems like that. And it's good for the company as well. We'd probably spend a whole podcast episode talking about governance. And Lee, did you want to add one more thing about that?
Yeah, I think that the whole notion of a real, true board of directors takes on new meaning in this environment, because when there is a funding round, you need somebody that understands from a business standpoint how that term sheet is going to be written. And especially if you're dealing with private equity or venture capital groups. I heard a story very recently about a company that didn't control its burn properly. It got stuck with a cram down round, and the white knight, so to speak, that came in and provided the funding. And this is a company, by the way, that had $30 million of ARR, annual recurring revenue. So it was not the earliest stage type of company, but there was a 3x liquidation preference that was demanded by the funding platform. And that's the cram down. The founders had no choice, because otherwise they were running out of money. And now the private equity group that came in and funded is effectively crammed down. The founders had worked on this project for 10 years, and they will get nothing out of this deal. Had they had seasoned professionals on their board of directors that understood term sheets, those professional directors would have said long ago, you need to cut the burn and not put yourself in a position where you're subject to a cram down like this, and do not accept a 3x liquidation preference, because you're going to end up with nothing. And it's a shame to see that happen. That's not something we would want to do to founders at all. But without the professional board, as opposed to a rubber stamp board, we've seen rubber stamp boards that do whatever the founders want done. That is just it's folly, especially in this environment where it's so hard to raise capital.
That's right. It's really a recipe for success. And I mean, the company and the founder are also missing out on just a wealth of knowledge that they could be really capitalizing on by constructing the right kind of board of directors. Switching gears a bit, Lee, let's talk about artificial intelligence and what that's meant now for at least our due diligence process, and how it could have a positive or negative impact on so many of these companies that we're looking at.
Yes, I would tell you that if a founder, if asked, how is AI and machine learning, ML, how are those going to impact your company, and they don't know, then we'd have to take a real hard look at whether we want to invest in that company. Artificial intelligence and machine learning is, as probably everybody knows, is the rage right now. But it is truly happening, and it's happening at light speed. Something that you look at today may change later today, it may change tomorrow or next week. And we're interested in knowing how AI particularly is going to be utilized by a company that in which we invest, but also how its competitors would potentially use it. And could the company be obsolete? Could this be a project somebody works on for 2 or 3 years, especially in the software world? They work on for 2 or 3 years. You don't have the kind of IP protection with software that you have with capital assets, particularly. And could artificial intelligence render that whole project obsolete? And so the investment that we might make in that company is 100% gone because nobody needs it at that point. So, that's kind of the thing that has to be pondered right now. And the problem with it is nobody knows enough about AI and machine learning and what its impact really will be to make great judgments about it. But we need to have founders that are looking at it very hard. We need to have boards of directors that are looking at it very hard. I asked a question in a board meeting this week about AI and was pleased to hear that the early stage company in which we've invested has already embraced it and is using it. And fortunately, nobody can see how it could have a detrimental effect from a competitive landscape standpoint on the company. But if founders aren't looking at it from a due diligence standpoint, that's a red flag for me.
And I would just add, like, we're not even talking about AI ML companies. Like, I see, you know, headlines every day about Sequoia or whoever making big investments in that space. We're talking about, you know, our type of companies, agriculture, animal health, human health, that aren't developing that technology necessarily, but there are ways that it can be utilized or incorporated or overlay on top of their business model. So there's all sorts of different, like, opportunities and potential threats, I would say, to pretty much any company, even some of these science-based companies, where they're, I mean, maybe there's an opportunity for them to really accelerate their research efforts or data generation efforts, thanks to an AI technology. So lots of different opportunities either way. Lee, let's expand on something you mentioned before as well. Valuations, you know, that we've seen really come down to earth over the last 12 months or so. I think a key component of that is that investors are paying even more attention to traction, even at the seed stage. So what we like to see with companies, especially those, like, even on the scientific side, we like to see that there's real data, maybe clinical level data on some of these scientific companies, but real evidence that is statistically significant, that their solution is meaningful. I think oftentimes in the past, maybe that used to come at the Series A stage after the company had already had some funding and moved through a couple phases of that process. But I've seen that come earlier and earlier in terms of the development timeline of a company. So we do want to see that there's proof that what this company says they can do, they really can do it. So I think that can come in these, you know, R&D-based companies and scientific companies, companies that have a product to sell. If they're already generating revenue, what's that growth been in revenue? And over what length of time? If the company has been generating revenue for 6 months, but in total, they've only generated $10,000. I mean, that's just a blip, really. So we would look even closer at that and say, well, what's the rate of increase over time? What's that acceleration of revenue growth? And it's been kind of like up and down, up and down. That's really not very exciting for us. But if it's been increasing exponentially, that's very interesting for us. And then what's the total addressable market, all those other components that go into growth opportunities. If a company is pre-revenue, how have they really primed their way to start generating revenue? Do they have paid pilots, or are their customers, people they're calling customers anyway, just using some sort of freemium model? We really take a close look at all those components of different companies, where their traction is. And we feel like valuations should reflect that. They should reflect the traction that the company has already achieved, in addition to the potential upside down the road. Lee, what would you like to add to how we look at traction and how it relates to valuation?
Yeah, I think that the one proviso here is if you've been in an accelerator program, and this isn't a diss on accelerator programs, but a lot of times we see companies that come out of these accelerators with these highfalutin ideas about valuation. They're told to price high, and I don't know if they're still doing that in this environment. But companies are not well served by doing that currently. That worked back in the go-go day in 2020, 2021, but we're back down to earth now. And if you come in with a valuation that smacks of 2020 or 2021, it isn't going to fly. Because if, unless you've got real revenue, real annual recurring revenue that supports that kind of valuation, don't go there. It will also hurt in the subsequent funding rounds that you need, that you were overvalued to begin with. We've already seen that happen before in our portfolio with a company that was a bit overvalued. They've struggled to get some traction. They pivoted, which was, pivoting is fine, but they're raising money at a lower valuation. So it's a down round effectively. And that's not helpful for anyone. So start out with a valuation that is realistic in the current economy, and discard any notion that you're coming in with a great idea and no revenue, but you're worth $12, $14, $15 million, because you're not. Mm-hmm. And that's, as part of the due diligence, that's something that we determine.
That's right. Well, Lee, I mean, we've gone through a lot of topics today, really talking about portfolio construction and then how to get there through due diligence. Are there any parting words or anything else you'd like to add as we wrap up today?
I don't think so.
Well, I think we've covered it all. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.